I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. One thing we've learned from the pandemic, grocery store workers are essential. With restaurants closed or limited to outdoor dining, more of us are eating at home, and online supermarket sales have soared. Grocery shopping can also bring out the worst in us with panic buying and hoarding staples like toilet paper and bread. So what does it take to keep those shelves stocked to meet the growing demands of choice and convenience and cost? Our guest Benjamin Lohr spent 5 years investigating that question, working at Whole Foods, riding along with a long-haul trucker, talking with farm workers and Thai shrimp laborers, eating his way through a food trade show. His new book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, is about the extraordinary efficiencies of the industry and the human and environmental costs involved. He writes that we spend 2% of our lives shopping at the grocery store. Benjamin Lohr, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Your first book was on the Bikram yoga community. What about that book led to this book?
Well, there is a very direct connection in my mind, actually. So I err on the side of being kind of an immersive journalist who wants to get as close to the people I'm kind of writing about as possible. And so for the Bikram book, I did gobs of Bikram yoga. It dominated my life. And during one particularly trying journalistic stretch, I went to the Bikram yoga teacher training, which is 9 weeks of full-time yoga. You're doing two classes a day. And you're kind of marooned at a hotel. And I was there studying, like, why are these people involved in this obsessive yoga practice and attracted to this kind of megalomaniacal guru, Bikram Chowdhury, who the book, you know, goes on to show had a pattern of sexual assault and all sorts of horrible things. And then in the middle of this yoga training, they release people from the hotel to go buy groceries. And they took every one of these yoga trainees to a Trader Joe's. And I just watched them descend into this like kids going to an amusement park. It was like maniacal glee on their faces. And I guess a light bulb kind of went off that there was a very big parallel in my mind that the grocery store was not the grocery store of my childhood anymore. That something that could give this much pleasure to like adults had really taken on a different type of cultural significance than the kind of drab places I remember going as a kid. And I wanted to understand that cultural shift. And then I just wanted to understand how it all works.
Sure. And I want to get to all of that. I do have to say, I've never experienced that kind of glee that these yoga practitioners had when they went to Trader Joe's. Maybe it was being holed up in a motel or hotel room for so many years. But it is, or months or even weeks. But it is interesting when you sort of look at our grocery stores, especially the ones that are so well stocked from afar or from a distance, the amount of abundance is just extraordinary. I think we get used to it, but if you stand back and look at it, it's extraordinary.
Oh, it's incredible. There's never been anything like the American-style supermarket in the history of the human project. You know, kings and emperors never had access to a fraction of the options that we have in our lives. At a beck and call. And it's funny that you say, like, I do think the grocery store is really polarizing. I fall into the camp of people who are endlessly stunned by this abundance I'll go on vacation and want to stroll the aisles and just feel there's some interesting mixture of relaxation and kind of surreal abundance that draws me to it. And then there's other people like you who are like, oh, terrible chore. Please let me limit
off my
time.
List. And yes, exactly. It's funny you mentioned going to other countries. I remember visiting actually my brother who was studying in France and going to a French supermarket and the aisles and aisles of cheese, which tells you a lot about French culture and how people live their lives.
Yeah, and that becomes kind of a small theme in the book of just how much these institutions reflect us as consumers and how responsive they are. And, you know, I think in food discourse right now, there's kind of a dominant narrative that there are these global agribusinesses that are giant and kind of like the global cafeteria lady that's greedy, profit-driven, and doesn't really care about you as a consumer as long as they're getting their margin. And that's just not true for the grocery industry, which is incredibly responsive, has razor-thin margins, and therefore, you know, really does reflect to be successful, has to reflect consumer demand in a way that a lot of people don't think of industrial food systems as doing.
In fact, you say the margin is something like 1.5%. That's really a small margin for error. A snowstorm can, you know, blow out business for a couple of days.
Absolutely. Groceries are a volume game. That was kind of the big innovative shift that moved from pre-grocery world of the general store into the supermarket was, if we sell lots of this stuff and we kind of mix up the margins that we're taking, so there's some high margin goods mixed in there, but most things are razor thin margins, it'll create this buying frenzy where people see prices that are so low, it kind of blows their mind, and they're going to stock up on everything. And that creates a feedback loop that allows the low margin game to actually get enough profits.
I do want to get to that, but just to acknowledge the fact that, yes, there are plenty of communities that have well-stocked and kind of high-end grocery stores like Whole Foods where you worked, but there are plenty of communities, they tend to be low-income communities, certainly in Philadelphia, where there are no supermarkets. You've got, you know, mom and pop, you've got a grocery store or a little corner store on the market. Maybe they have some apples, maybe some bananas, but mostly it's processed food. So we have many divides in this country, and it seems like food is one of them as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the grocery store reflects... And that is another big theme of this book, but just how much wealth and equity gets imprinted on how we get food and what we think of as healthy food. And in particular, in the grocery store, the divide between what we think of as consumer values and labor values. And of course, for most of us, we're both consumers and laborers. So taking out of, you know, giving to one part by taking from the other doesn't necessarily add up to a whole.
Well, let's talk about Whole Foods, where you worked for a while behind the fish counter. Tell us about the kind of training that you got.
Well, there was 2 days. I part of the book, I wanted to get as close as possible to the grocery store, and I just didn't think I could do that without working the retail floor. And, you know, I was spending a lot of time trying to understand the Thai seafood industry and the commodity chain that brings products from there. So I went to work at the Whole Foods. The training was a blitz of what I guess I would call Whole Foods propaganda, this kind of like message that you are super special for having been chosen to work here. And this is an amazing opportunity for you to have, and you're going to be part of this team. And then some kind of standard pro forma safety instruction that was, you know, not quite as rigorously followed up on during the job itself. But the overwhelming message was, you're a team player here, play for our team. And what was interesting was just how that rhetoric, especially with the low wage jobs and especially with kind of the changes to scheduling, how self-serving that, you know, you are lucky to be a member of that team because there was a chance that maybe they'd ask for you to play for another team, i.e. get fired, if you weren't kind of bellowing up to the bar.
Well, you described the scheduling, and this is true for the fast food industry as well, just-in-time scheduling. So while many people have, you know, a version of 9-to-5 for a lot of workers in the grocery industry, it doesn't work that way if you're working at a grocery store, and that was certainly true for you at Whole Foods, where you would find out maybe the day before, oh, you're going to work from 3 to whatever.
Yeah, and I think this was surprising. You know, I've worked a lot of low wage, minimum wage jobs. I think maybe it goes with the territory of being a writer, but I had kind of nostalgic memories of those. You know, they were things that I did in high school or right out of college. And the landscape has changed. The retail landscape has changed. The idea that you are going to get a schedule a week in advance is no longer the case for a lot of different industries. And so that variable scheduling or just-in-time scheduling, where as a worker, you're really expected to be on call for the whole week. You get your schedule, three days ahead of time, and it might change right before. You might show up for a shift and be told that actually there's no consumer demand, so it's time to go home. Or you might be called and asked to come in. And that it takes these jobs that are not necessarily full-time jobs, not able to provide a living wage in which you might partner with another job, and makes it impossible to get that second job because there's no coherent schedule to work around. And they might be asking the same kind of crazy scheduling demands. And it just that shift, which we understand for, an essential worker and a first responder, they're compensated in respect and pay in ways that obviously retail workers are not.
You do describe, you worked behind the fish counter, and actually you go on for several pages describing what it was like. I guess there was the monthly cleaning of the fish counter and the, I feel a little nauseous even saying this, the kind of stench that came from cleaning the fish counter. Just how disgusting was that?
Well, that was extraordinarily disgusting. And I think I say in the book, look, this is a book where I really went close to a lot of gross smells, whether it was wading through fecal lagoons to break into a factory farm, or going to Thailand and looking at trash fish, which form the base of the kind of aquaculture pyramid that that's where cat food and fish food come from. Make up our farmed fish industry. Those were gross smells, but this was in, Whole Foods in New York City. I will say, and I make it very clear in the book, that primarily why I focus on this is not to gross people out, but because it seemed to me a potent metaphor for the grocery industry at large, which is, I think that the Whole Foods fish counters were perfectly hygienic on the surface level. I don't doubt that the fish that was being sold was good, clean fish. But if you started digging below the ice on that counter, and you got to that bottom level with this shaky, ineffectual freezer that would allow kind of drips from the top to get down there, and then they would kind of rest down there till that monthly cleaning came along and rot, you would reach this
Yikes.
disgusting bottom. And to me, that felt like more important to get out there as a metaphor than as something to really turn people off of the Whole Foods fish counter. Like, I don't think it was a particularly like egregious example of a bad health practice, so much as it was representative of the fact that as consumers, we get something that's perfectly hygienic and clean. But if you dig into the process, there's a lot of muck that goes into creating that.
You know, Benjamin, we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Benjamin Lohr. We're talking about his new book, The Secret Life of Groceries: The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So, what does it take to keep our supermarket shelves stocked? And I'm talking with Benjamin Lohr. He spent 5 years investigating our food supply chain and the workers who keep us fed. And again, he's got a new book, The Secret Life of Groceries: The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And we want to hear from people. Our listeners who have worked at grocery stores are working at grocery stores now, whether stocking shelves or working behind the fish counter or working at checkout. And you can do that by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Benjamin, Stu has a quick question here, something we were talking about right before the break. He says, don't confuse margins with profits. The margin is low, but the volumes are very high, therefore immense profits. Can you speak to that?
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the reason the grocery store can work, because food is a continuously purchased good. It's not something we buy once or twice a year. Everyone is spending a significant portion of their money at a grocery store. So, yes, you keep the margins low, but the volume of goods that you're buying relates, you know, results in high profits. It's, I can also say that the grocery stores have quietly found other methods of generating those profits beyond simply consumer purchases. And this is something I get into the book when I follow a food entrepreneur who's trying to get her product on shelf and all the hurdles she has to go to. But she's not just competing against other entrepreneurs in her category. She was selling a condiment called Slossa, which is kind of this brilliant combination of coleslaw and salsa. And she, it turns out she's competing primarily against the store, which is coming for some of her profits in the form of slotting fees, which is just payments to get on the shelf, or other forms of trade spends like buy one, get one frees, or free fill, where you're just giving cases to the store to sell at 100% margin. And these alternative ways of finding money are a major profit center for the grocery store that have nothing to do with the margin they're getting on any individual profit product.
And she obviously has to compete with big name brands. What did Slossa taste like? Again, coleslaw and salsa. I just couldn't wrap my taste buds around that.
Slossa? One, I made a bargain with myself that I wouldn't follow a food entrepreneur of a product that I didn't enjoy. So I filtered out to only the products I would like. And so I like Slossa quite a bit. It's interesting because I think it doesn't totally make sense until you have it with a meat or you grill with it. But it it's a southern chow chow. I think it's a descendant from.
Oh, sure.
And so it's got a little turmeric in it. It's just mild enough and crunchy cabbage with some vinegar and some heat that it's a nice partner for like a bratwurst. But you might not have it all by itself.
Her name was Julie. Her name is actually Julie Boucher, and you went with her to a supermarket.
Boucher.
Yeah. Went with her to see where her product was on the shelf, and there it was way down below, kind of hidden with some of the other sort of less name brandy condiments.
That's right. I don't think you get a sense of just how vast a supermarket is and what it means. Those 32 to 125,000 different items that can be found in your local supermarket until you're searching through one with somebody looking for their baby. And Slossa was very much Julie's baby. It's this small product that she's bringing to market. She's hustling for, she's going store to store, pitching buyers on. Like I said, they're coming at her with all these extractive demands. Can you give us, money just so we put it on the shelf? And if you don't pay this, then you may not have any opportunities to sell your product anywhere. And so seeing her amidst the volume of the supermarket was tough. There's just a lot out there that as consumers we take for granted.
Did she make it? Was she able to get her product on the shelves and sold
yes,
it and make some
yeah.
money?
Right as of now, I think COVID has been tough for a lot of food entrepreneurs. And so I imagine this has been a really tough year for her. But she's doing great. But I guess what goes unsaid here is how much, it's very much said in the book, but how much work Julie put into her product. She was working 70-hour weeks, waking up at the crack of dawn, firing out marketing emails, connecting to brokers. It was a full-time slog. And I think I walked into this thinking like, I make a good guacamole. I could find a bottler. I could kind of do this pretty easily as like a part-time thing. And then my like fantastic guacamole would be on the shelves. And it's just not about that. And in fact, the fact that I have a fantastic guacamole might even be a barrier because the things that grocery buyers are looking at really, taste is a fourth order decision. Compared to things like margin, things like the stability of the underlying commodities. They're not so focused on taste as much as shelf life and all these other variables.
Here's an interesting comment on our Facebook page from Marjorie. She says, 20 years ago, the first time I took an exchange student who was staying with us from the Czech Republic to a grocery store, he walked up and down the aisles shaking all the boxes because he could not believe that they were full. I mean, thank you, Marjorie. That's just sort of an extraordinary story about the abundance, the sheer abundance at so many supermarkets.
That's amazing because it's actually really nice to hear that because in the book I have this anecdote about the first grocery store, American style supermarket that opened up overseas. It's in 1956 in Rome. The USDA stages like this version of a supermarket with only like 2,000 brands, so very small. And the shoppers went crazy. Like they started shouting, "This must be heaven!" And I think that's another example of just the way we have let this thing that is completely miraculous in the history of humanity turn into something completely banal that we take for granted.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And I do want to talk about the trucker that you traveled with. That's Benjamin Lohr. We're talking about his new book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And again, if you have worked at a supermarket or working one now, we especially want to hear from you. But of course, we all shop there in one form or another. We can talk to you as well at email address radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Benjamin, you spent about 100 hours with a truck driver, a woman named Lynn Riles, hauling, what is it, Miracle Whip or some kind of whipped cream across the country?
Yeah, the woman I called Lynn was an OTR trucker, which means she just drove kind of non-dedicated routes, which basically, she crisscrossed the country. So Miracle Whip was certainly not the only thing she was hauling. She was hauling all sorts of things in the back. She had what's called a reefer truck, which is a refrigerated truck. So largely, this was groceries that she was delivering and taking to and from fulfillment centers and warehouses to the back of stores. And it was this is the part of the book that was probably the most eye-opening to me because the trucking world is something that, of course, you know, we intuitively know. You drive next to them on 95 and you kind of see them and you think, oh, they're doing something similar to what I'm doing. And it's just not the case. Trucking is an industry that has gone through great changes through deregulation. And in fact, I came to see that the portrait of Lynn that I give in the book is like a human face of what it means to deregulate an industry. Like these are terms that we throw around in the abstract. But trucking went from essentially a middle-class blue-collar job in the 1970s, you know, the time of Smokey and the Bandit and BJ and the Bear and all these outlaw truckers, to a place where the trucker is essentially a commodity and the trucker is interchangeable and kind of designed to be worn to failure. The turnover rate, but the rate that employees in the trucking industry come to and serve at a job and then leave the job is it's 98 to 110%, depending on the year that you're looking at it. So that means that everyone in a given job is leaving that job that same year because these jobs are pretty close to miserable.
No, that's okay. I mean, there's so many things to talk about with her. For one thing, you say that she takes home about $17,000 a year, and you list all the things that cost her, including renting the truck and all the ancillary costs that come out of her paycheck. Taking home $17,000 a year and working as hard as she does, I mean, it's really extraordinary. That used to be a middle-class job, even an upper-middle-class job, and you could support a full family if you were a truck driver. Not anymore.
And it really, there's a lot of dots to connect here. One of the dots to connect is, look, this deregulation resulted in cheaper freight and it resulted in cheaper prices for groceries at checkout. There's no doubt in my mind that that is true. It also created a system of debt peonage for the trucker often where, as you noted, Lynn was grossing $200,000, working about 80 hours a week. In a state of constant vigilance, because if you're a trucker, trucking is one of the most dangerous professions out there. For people who don't know, the most fatalities in any profession occur in trucking. So it's right up there with timber and deep sea fishing and all the lists of dangerous jobs. She was taking home $17,000 from that. And she was also living in her cab at the time. She was, ostensibly homeless. She didn't have a fixed address. And she was part of what was called a class of owner operators, which essentially means she had entered in a lease agreement to buy her truck. And that put her at the mercy of the carrier. She was dependent on them. Part of her lease agreement, you know, meant that she had to use their garages, their lawyers, their accountants. And they also took a flat percentage of her gross for the right to use their shipping authority. And beyond all those fixed cost deductions, it meant she just couldn't navigate the market and get the best priced stuff out there in a fluid manner. She was really stuck to this one place. Mm-hmm. And watching that job, you understand why there's such high turnover. It was not the week I was with her. She took home $100 flat for that 80-hour work week because of all the deductions in her paycheck.
Well, you describe there are jobs where it's impossible to succeed and jobs that are designed to fail, describing what it's like to be a trucker these days. You also write, and I thought, just because, you know, if we're driving in our cars, we don't get to see what truckers get to see, but you write, the vigilance required is exhausting and lonesome. The four-wheelers below, Lynn tells me, are completely unaware of the dangers lurking above them and must be managed like children. And you go on from there just describing the kind of alertness that she has to have in order to stay safe. People doing crazy things in cars, which of course they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing to say about trucking is that I think people don't get is just how big it is and how essential it is. So there's 10.7 billion tons of freight that's being moved around every year, which breaks down to about 350 pounds per person per day moving around. So that means, like, on my behalf, there's about 350 pounds of stuff being moved to support my lifestyle. And it really is everything. Because of the last mile problem, everything in your life comes to you on a truck, whether you're doing it DIY or whether you're doing Amazon, one-day shipping. The truck is inevitably attached to almost everything we consume. And so the plight of these truckers is, it's connected to our economic system in a really visceral way that I wanted to highlight.
You describe her drinking something like 12 Pepsis a day. She was a chain smoker. She also talked nonstop, right? Talked your ear off.
Yes, yes. she had she had awesome amounts of alone time. And I think that comes on the truck. And there's only so much of that you fill through, like, the CB radio or the phone these days. But she was a chatty. She was chatty. That's for sure.
Fills those hours. Here's an email from Joan. She says, my son worked at Whole Foods in Philly for 2 years as a cheesemonger. He learned a bit about cheese, but how he was treated and the issues of cleanliness were, as your guest says, waste, so much waste. If the electricity went out, all food from fridges were thrown out. This might be perfectly good food, but Whole Foods said they couldn't donate it because of potential lawsuits and employees couldn't take it home. Can you speak to that? I mean, there are laws about, what happens when the electricity goes out and wanting to ensure that the food that we have is safe, that it's not going to hurt us. But can you speak to that, Benjamin?
I can't speak to that as much as you might want me to. I mean, I can speak to it in a very general sense, which is to validate the idea that there is enormous amount of waste all up and down the supply chain. It's a huge issue that that comes part and parcel with the kind of consumer demands that we're putting on, which is hyper efficiency, hyper convenience, and high quality. And when you start insisting on all of these values at once, then you get a system that produces a lot of waste because it deems a lot of products from, imperfect vegetables and fruits that get left on the field to cheese that may have what we would consider completely safe health violation, still safe to eat, but may have violated a health regulation, gets thrown out.
That's absolutely true. What I can't talk to too much of the specifics. I steered away from the Waste because I thought it had been written about really well by others.
Here's an email from Breyer who says, the grocery store is my zen place. I will travel hours to get an interesting grocery store and spend an hour examining aisles of pickled foods from across Central Europe or noodles in an Asian market or halal meats and interesting legumes. People who really love to cook love grocery stores for inspiration. Here's a comment from Nicole who says, I never understood why we need so many different brands of the same product, often made in the same factories but given different brand labels. I think it contributes to the myth that American culture somehow allows for unique abundance when really it just creates profound waste. Ben, we're almost up on a break here, but anything you want to say to either of our listeners there?
I have stuff to say to both of them. I guess to the zenned out grocery shopper, we are one in that sense. I have exactly the same experience. And I think that was actually a very foundational experience that led me to want to write the book. The idea that walking the grocery aisles was soothing, and I felt like it was a stand-in for a certain type of American privilege that I wanted to unpack. And privilege, I know, is like one of those words that like fluoresces these days, and I hesitate to totally use it. But I think the grocery store, with that soothing quality and the fact that there's immense power and resources that go into it, really is a great microcosm for unpacking all these things that we take for granted that go into this soothing lifestyle.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Benjamin Lohr, and he's got a new book we're talking about, and it's called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And again, we want to hear from the supermarket workers in our audience. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We're going to talk about Thai fish after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Benjamin Lohr. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what he learned spending 5 years investigating our food supply chain and the workers who keep us fed. And his new book is titled The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. I do want to, Benjamin, talk about what you, who you met and what you learned when you went to Thailand. We've done several shows, as many others have, looking at the kind of slave labor conditions when it comes to some of these fish farms and shrimp farms that are in Southeast Asia. But you met a man named Thun Linh, a laborer from Myanmar. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Sure. So Thun Linh, I guess I went to Thailand because I wanted to understand what happens at the way bottom of these commodity chains. And actually, like the emailer who was talking about the fact that a lot of our products are made in the same factories and then they get different brand identifiers on them, that's because those factories source from these kind of underlying commodities. And to get the volume of food we need to source to keep the American grocery industry running, it's just so enormous that the supply chains don't look the way we think of. They're not some smooth flow chart. they're enormously tangled entities with brokers and aggregators, and to sort through that and get to kind of like the human face on the bottom is extremely difficult, even for those on the inside. And so Thun Linh is a migrant from the Mon state of Myanmar who essentially was born in a place with no real job opportunities, and he leaves to go to Thailand, which is a bordering nation, an economic, regional economic powerhouse. He spends a lot of time as a child daydreaming about Thai factories because that offers the promise of that he could support his family, which was kind of being undone by starvation and war. And in the process, he travels there, illegally crosses the border, and then gets hooked up with a labor broker who essentially kidnaps him and puts him onto a seafood boat. And I tell that story in pretty great detail. But it highlights a few things that I think are really interesting, which one is just how much the traffic labor problem, it's not a simple problem. Like Tun Lin was very active agent in his own, you know, he was looking for a better life. The fact is that there weren't opportunities for that. And the only routes that he had to do that involved doing some illegal things, which put him in jeopardy. And then, you know, he ends up on this Thai boat that it's out at sea for 6 months to a year at a time. He's forced to work. He's beaten if he's not working. He's working 20-hour days, sleeping very, very little. He watches his best friend on the boat get killed for not working. He's essentially an imprisoned slave laborer. Right, the type of abuse that I think is stunning to think exists in the 21st century. Yet it does, and it's in the shrimp seafood industry, it's not just exists, but it's really responsible for low prices. You know, when I was researching, people in NGOs would quote 15% to 60%, which is obviously an insanely high error bar, but 15% to 60% of labor was this type of brokered enslaved labor that Tun Lin was caught in.
Well, reading that section and hearing you describe Tun Lin and the conditions under which he worked, you know, one of the reflex responses is, well, then we should boycott, you know, shrimp and fish that comes from these inhumane conditions. How would that affect someone's life like Tun Lin if we did that as a protest for these conditions?
It's a really tough thing, and it's unfortunately it pushes right up to the limits of like what control we have as consumers. And so to answer your question directly, there's no great answer to that question. I think if I, having spent time with Tun Lin and other traffic laborers, I don't really want to buy Thai shrimp anymore. I know how difficult it is to source it ethically and the problems with even the best companies with the best intentions trying to do that. On the other hand, my ability to enact that ideal as a consumer is really limited. And like you said, the idea that by boycotting Thai shrimp, you're making Tun Lin's life better, is not at all true. One, the industry is designed, these are commodities, it's designed for displacement, which means that if you crack down in Thailand, it finds its low price somewhere else by moving to India or Indonesia or wherever in a globalized marketplace, allowing the same labor issues to crop up. It also penalizes the firms in Thailand that often do respond and start enacting reforms at the same time. Which is kind of what's playing out right now. There was an incredible amount of attention on this seafood slavery in Thailand, and there were reforms enacted. And a lot of the people I spoke to in the book felt like Thailand would be punished for enacting those reforms, which is very ironic, obviously. Sure. And third, to the laborer itself, you know, this goes to what I was saying about him being kind of an active agent in his survival. It's not quite the same image of somebody who was kidnapped, although he certainly was kidnapped at various points in his journey. People who get pushed out of these marginal spaces in labor markets, you know, whether it's child labor or some forms of bondage, often don't surface in like a good job. They get pushed into even more marginalized places. And you know, one researcher I talked to talked about that, the sex trade being like a natural place that you get pushed out of a child labor market and suddenly you find yourself with very little other options. Mm-hmm. To tie this up, I guess in my mind, it's the limits of this notion that I grew up with, which is like you vote with your dollars and we can vote for a better world by buying the right products. And that's very much what I walked into this book thinking. And I think we've hit the limits of that. What the solutions to our food system are not going to come from within the food system. They're going to come from big policy level decisions, whether that's actually having trade treaties with teeth, enforcement teeth, and globalizing labor standards, or you know strengthening unions and workers' rights and ways for workers to self-advocate, but not through by putting the weight of these problems on grocery stores and expecting them to clean up the world.
Here's a related question. I do want to get back to some of our listeners here, but having to do with labeling, whether something is GMO-free or free-range or organic or fair trade, shoppers who want to be ethical shoppers, you know, look to those labels to think, okay, I'm at least doing a moderately good thing. Were you ever able to deconstruct what all that means?
I spent a lot of time trying. So first of all, most labels, is a $50 billion for-profit industry that certifies different products on food. And there's a huge range of them. And it's a relatively recent industry. It kind of emerges in the late 90s in response to consumer demands and in response to like horrendous food safety violations like Jack in the Box and Odwalla Juice. There's just a number of really basic problems with the certification regime. Right now, it largely is dominated by what's known as audits, which are snapshot looks at a one-time, you know, visit to a factory or a farm. And that serves tolerably well for something like a food safety violation where there's kind of an empirical stain that's left by the bad practices. But for things like labor, fair trade, environmental things, non-empirical, you know, if someone's withholding wages, it's really hard to go to a factory where you don't speak the language, can't really talk to the workers freely because they might feel they can't speak freely, and get that information. It's even more difficult if you're trying to uncover like wage violations that happened 2 weeks to 6 months before your actual one-day visit. And so there's just a level of inadequacy with the audits that underpin the certifications that everyone in the industry is very aware of. No one spoke up with like a feisty defense of the audit regime, but there's a lack of good options out there. And I don't think as consumers, we really understand that that's the dynamics in play behind these.
Oh, and just a quick follow-up. I mean, interestingly, in this rather complicated and unwieldy system, food safety in this country is relatively good and reliable. That's one of the takeaways from your book, Benjamin. Just quickly, and then I do want to get a caller to join us.
Absolutely. I'd say the food safety has improved greatly. And part of the reason is that food safety audits have served as some form of accountability. Part of the reason is that there's enormous tort judgments. You know, defense lawyers will get these $10 million judgments if you end up poisoning some adorable child with your hamburger. And that is also a big reason for improved standards.
Let me get Robert from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hey Marty. Hi,
hey,
Ben. So we're members of Weaver's Way Co-op, food co-op here in Philadelphia. They have three different locations. We've been members for a number of years. And that means that we're in a supermarket these days, on rare occasion to, you know, get a gallon of Clorox, that kind of thing. So do you have any take on what the impact that food cooperatives and that whole movement is having on the national industry?
Robert, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Benjamin, Weaver's Way has been around for many, many years and a very well-known food co-op here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think there's different levels where cooperatives... So the short answer is, I don't have a short answer. I think they're very positive impacts from a lot of cooperatives. They're not the dominant way that people are getting their food and entering in this system. So part of the goal would be to grow their reach. I think that one of the lessons from the book is the more you scale up and the more you have to deal with the continuous abundance of sourcing product, the more difficult this gets to do a good job and to purchase with integrity. And so the more you can shrink that down, whether it's like Trader Joe's does by shrinking the amount of products that it offers and just deciding you're not going to play the 30,000 item game that other people are playing, or with cooperatives that can ostensibly form deep because their buyers are not sourcing from everywhere, but are have kind of ethical underpinnings of how they're doing and form deeper relationships with the people that they're sourcing with. Again, probably by excluding the world of options. Those are, I think, very viable ways for reforming. What's interesting is they do undo the notion of the supermarket that kind of entrances people, which is that they consciously are not offering all 60,000 items because that becomes the unsustainable part.
Sure. Sure, Robert, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Joyce. She says, my introduction to enjoying food in a store was being in my Nana and Papa's grocery store in Brooklyn, New York. We lived a block away. As I grew up, I loved to watch my grandfather check the eggs for fertilized eggs, pull a pickle out of the barrel, eat the delicious cheese and fresh bread and sliced lox that Papa gave us. I loved the smell of the ground coffee from the machine and ate grounds to see what the grounds tasted like. I miss that wonderful little store. That's a lovely email from Joyce. Let me just toss something else out here, and this has to do with eggs. And I want to quote you, Benjamin, you did go into an egg factory, and you write in your book, I saw terrible weird things, but I left just as I entered, capable at moments of seeing it like the USDA slides and capable of seeing it like the vegans. It was not filthy nor a hellscape. It was instead an intensely alien, highly functional place for animals to live a sad short life before they were set to die. It's a poignant sentence and raises a whole host of issues about just the fact that we have to live with these choices that we make and whether we know it or not.
Yeah, I came to see my visits to factory farms as real windows into just, yeah, those choices that we have to make as a society that has such giant population numbers and unwavering demands for the quality of life that they, yeah, that we want to live. And I don't say that with any scorn, like we should be living differently necessarily. But when you add it all up, it reaches to some absurd places. And I think that factory egg house and the broiler chicken houses, the swine yards that I visit, really showed that, because by any measure, those places are inhumane is not the right word, but they're horrific. I mean, they're just mind boggling. On the other hand, you can clearly see, I saw that there was a great effort in keeping them, they make a profit based on percent survivability and healthy animals live. They're trying as hard as they can to make those conditions as humane as possible. And it really, I guess the dizzying volume of what it takes to bring food came clear to me visiting those and just how little I had to offer in the way of concrete moral solutions. And it really paved the way for a book that's very descriptive and not prescriptive.
Not at all. Benjamin Lohr, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. You can find out more about the program. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. We often do transcripts of our shows. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.